A few years ago, when UNICEF doctors had trouble getting Indonesian children to come in for tuberculosis inoculations, they arranged to have the movie film Tarzan and the Leopard Woman run in the local theater. Price of the admission? Acceptance of an injection. From then on, it was standing room only, and no more difficulty in getting the children immunized. Movie people assert that a Tarzan picture is playing somewhere in the world every day of the year. One theater in Egypt has been showing the same Tarzan film for 20 years, replacing each worn-out print with a duplicate. The 24 Tarzan books, translated into more than 30 languages, are today more widely read than ever in paperback editions. The word Tarzan can be found in almost any standard dictionary. Even Aborigines, ignorant of any other English word, know that one from the 39 Tarzan movies made to date, the Tarzan comic strip, or the syndicated television and radio series swinging around the world. On today's program of Kaleidoscope, we look at the man who wrote the story, and the man, Tarzan. Today, the story of the King of the Jungle, Edgar Rice Burroughs. Tarzan's creator, a man whose name was Edgar Rice Burroughs, died 26 years ago. The Los Angeles Times commented, "Few writers have reached a larger audience, yet he was free of arty pretense. He neither went to college nor to Africa. He said he was an escapist, that he wrote to escape being broke." Burroughs' writing was certainly unadulterated escapism. The record of his life explains his urge to create a brighter, more exciting world than the one he knew. He had been through a dozen different occupations and failed at all of them. When his second child was born, he met expenses by hawking his wife's jewelry and his own watch. Then in the year of 1911, at the age of 36, out of utter desperation, he began writing a story. The locale of Edgar Rice Burroughs' first book, written in someone else's office after hours so that his wife wouldn't know about one more unpromising venture, was Mars, an ideal setting since no one could question the descriptive details. The yarn, titled Under the Moon of Mars and serialized in 6 installments in All Story magazine, brought the author $400. His second effort, a historical novel, The Outlaw of Torn, was thumpingly rejected. But the $400 sale, a fortune to him then, haunted Burroughs, and before long, he had a new idea. This time, he did research reading Stanley's In Darkest Africa and Kipling's Jungle Book in the Chicago Public Library. The result was Burroughs' third book, Tarzan of the Apes, inspired, he said, by the legend of Romulus and Remus, who were suckled by a wolf and founded Rome. It was written in his spare time on old business letterheads. The story was simple. John Clayton, Lord Greystoke, and his lovely wife Alice were marooned by a mutinous crew on an unexplored jungle coast of Africa in the year of 1888. Lady Alice was pregnant. She died shortly after their son was born, and her grief-stricken husband was soon killed by a vicious ape. The baby, suckled by an ape, matured into the magnificent specimen known to his anthropoid tribe as White Skin, Tarzan.
Tarzan of the Apes, a character of Edgar Rice Burroughs' famous book, in reality is the son of a titled English couple, Lord and Lady Greystoke, who were put ashore by a mutinous crew in the jungles of West Africa. The maroon couple were left with tools and firearms, and Tarzan's mother and father built the little hut in which Tarzan is born a year afterward. It's the night of their little son's first birthday. Lord and Lady Greystoke are sitting in their rude but strongly built home. Around them lies the jungle, dark, mysterious, teeming with great sinister shapes, mocking with dreadful quiet through the night. The roar of a lion tells that the mighty monarch of the forest has made its kill. And from farther away can be heard the hideous laughing cry of the hyenas, echoing the lion's thunderous roar. The wind rustles the leaves of the trees outside. Both are startled.
What's that, John?
Yes. Yes. I heard it too. Oh, it's only the wind in the trees, dear.
It gave me rather a start.
It did me too for a moment. Silly of both of us. Nothing short of a herd of elephants could force its way in here. I confess a bit of pride. This place is built like a vault.
Oh, John, I know we're safe enough, but sometimes I don't think I can stand it a moment longer. It's the nights. They're dreadful. There, that's what I mean. All night long, the jungle seems to threaten us. And those hyenas, oh, that hideous cry of theirs. It's like the laugh of a maniac. They seem to be jeering at us. As though someday...
Now, Alice, get hold of yourself. You can't let go this way. You'll go mad. You have to hold tight, dear. For him.
For him. Oh, he's a year old today, John.
Yes, a year old and as sound as a nut. Sleeps through gunshots and everything.
He's a darling, isn't he, John? And the picture of you.
Nothing of the sort. He looks exactly like you. Oh, yes, he does, dear. Why, he has your eyes and that sweet little smile of his. Why, that's exactly like you, dear. There. He can't get through here. Too tight. I'll pop the beggar through the ladder.
John! He'll burst the door down. I know he will. Look at the bar.
Hush. Turn down that lamp so that I can get a bead on the beggar through here.
All right. There. Don't get your face too close to the lattice. He may strike through.
There. See through here. He's a big brute.
I don't want to look. Shoot him, John. Shoot him.
There, dear. Hold steady, and we'll have a lion's skin to wrap the baby in.
Hurry, John. Hurry. Every time he claws the door, it gives terribly.
Lord, he must be hungry to come up this way.
Oh, his eyes. They're terrible. Oh, those horrible teeth. Oh.
Stand away from my arm. I put that one right down his throat. Another one will settle him. There, that finishes Sir Liar. It's all over, dear. Why, he's as dead as a doorknob. Don't be frightened.
Oh, John, I'm sorry to go to pieces this way. Really, I am, but you know, the last few days, I've had a terrible premonition that something would happen. It's all silly, I know, but... oh, I can't escape this dreadful feeling.
You're just nervous, that's all. Why, any day now, we'll wake up and find a boat in the bay. And you and I and the little chap there will go sailing back to England.
Oh, it's been 2 years now, and there's been no boat. 2 terrible years, John.
Why, Alice, I can't understand this in you at all. Oh, buck up, my girl. Don't let it get you this way.
Oh, I'm sorry, John. It's like a terrible threat hanging over. Listen to the jungle now.
Why, there isn't a sound.
No. That shot quieted them for a little while. But the silences are the worst of all. The silence means that something awful and dreadful is passing through the jungle.
There. Your silence is broken for you. A panther.
Oh, John, I hate to show the white feather like this. And I shan't do it again. Now, there, that's a promise.
White feather? Oh, white rot. You've been marvelous, Alice. This infernal jungle is bound to get you once in a while. Come on, kiss me and forget it.
Gladly, sir. John. Which one of our neighbors is that?
A bully.
It's the apes I hate worst of all. They're so human and yet so far from human. Those long, powerful arms, their awkward gait and the terrific speed in which they swing and leap from branch to branch.
They are nasty beggars.
That one you shot yesterday. Oh, those nasty, close-set eyes and yellow fangs.
Come on now. Oh, forget it.
Again the cry of a huge bull ape. A brutish creature of terrible strength and awful temper. The ape has suddenly gone mad. Raging, foaming mad with that peculiar madness which suddenly seizes bull apes and quickly passes. He's running rampant among his people. The younger and lighter apes are scampering to the highest branches. Kayla, a young female, comes into the clearing. Her baby is clinging to her neck. She doesn't know. She doesn't know that Bull Apple's gone into one of his terrible rages. Bull Apple spies her. The others yell hoarse cries of warning. He's bearing down on her. She leaps from branch to branch. He has her by the ankle. She breaks loose. Up the tree she goes. Bull Apple behind her. She makes a terrific leap to another tree. She makes it. The jar tears her baby's grip loose from its mother's neck. It falls. Falls to the ground with a thud. Bull Apple's roaring grows fainter. Fainter as he hurls his powerful body through the trees.
That bull ape is certainly doing a lot of boasting tonight.
He sounds very close, John.
Oh, he's miles away. Those bull apes have tremendous lung power.
Beastly sound.
Yes.
John, it's getting a little cold. I think perhaps we'd better build a small fire. Baby sneezed this morning.
All right. I want to go out and drag that lion into the shed anyway before the hyenas get at the skin.
John, have you noticed how deathly still the jungle has suddenly become?
Just a lull. Where's the axe?
Over there in the corner. Just a few sticks will do, John. Just enough to keep the chill off.
Righto. Be back in a second.
Aren't you going to take your rifle?
Oh, I'll hardly need it. Just going out to the shed. I'll leave the door open. The light will keep any animals away.
All right.
You know, every time I open the latch on this door, I'm impressed with myself. Well, it's quite an invention, Alice.
Yes, dear. I have admired it before.
Oh, no.
Now run along and get the wood.
Yes, all right, dear.
The sound of Greystoke's axe echoes through the strangely silent jungle. Greystoke doesn't notice the fearful tenseness of the silence. The jungle is cringing, cringing away from a monstrous shadow which moves ominously through the hushed and fearful night. A huge ape comes to the clearing. It is Borat, the crazed derelict of the jungle. He halts. His insane, bloodshot eyes catch sight of the unsuspecting Greystoke. They gleam hatred from beneath his shaggy brows. He bares his fangs as though in a horrid snarl. But no sound comes from his great throat. Slowly, noiselessly, the 350 pounds of stifled rage moves across the clearing. bolt upright, his mighty arms dangling loose at his side. A shadow falls across the log which Greystoke is chopping. He looks up into the beastly, snarling face of the brute.
Oh!
The ape makes a lunge at Greystoke.
Ah! Close the door!
Greystoke raises his axe, brings it down with terrific force. The ape catches the axe in his terrible hands and flings it from him. With bared fangs, he leaps at Greystoke. We continue with Edgar Rice Burroughs' famous story, Tarzan of the Apes. Greystoke throws himself flat on his face. The ape lunges past. Greystoke regains his feet. The ape is faster. Greystoke is running for the hut. The great ape, in one powerful leap, cuts him off. It's too late. Those horrible, hairy hands are reaching for him. Greystoke turns. His face is a horrible mask of terror. He looks into those inflamed, raging eyes. Bolat voices a terrible cry. A cry dreadful to hear. He springs. The man crushes his fist into the hairy face. It serves only to infuriate the brute. The huge mouth of the ape opens. His yellow fangs gleam. Greystoke struggles futilely to escape the mighty clutch. The hot, fetid breath of the bull ape is on the man's face. It is the end. The end. Oh, there's no chance now. A shot. From where? The great ape screams with pain. Slowly the great body sags until it drops on all fours, motionless. Greystoke watches the flame go out of the great beast's eyes. With a sighing grunt, the great man-beast of the forest topples over dead. Its jaws fall open. Its eyes grow cold, glazed. For a moment, Greystoke stands in frozen horror and wonderment. Then slowly realization dawns on him. His wife had shot the brute. He whirls and staggers to the cabin.
Alice. Alice. It's all right, dear. You shot him. Oh, Alice. Where's the water? Where's the water?
It was ghastly.
There, darling, there. Everything is all right. It's all over, dear. I'm safe. And the brute is dead.
Oh, the beast, the beast.
Now, steady now. Everything is all right. He's dead, dear. Don't get excited. Relax, Alice. You're a little hysterical, that's all. Just a little hysterical.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan. And so we have heard an excerpt, the original radio broadcast, the first broadcast, as Tarzan came to the airwaves back in the 1930s. Years later, when an American professor and his beautiful daughter Jane were abandoned in the jungle by a crew of pirates, Tarzan, by then king of his tribe, rescued them from numerous perils. When Jane left for home, the love-struck Tarzan followed, only apparently to lose her to another out of a confused sense of honor. The story ended with a cliffhanger. What came of his noble act of self-renunciation will be told in the next book. Today on Kaleidoscope, our presentation, King of the Jungle, the story of Edgar Rice Burroughs and his creation, Tarzan of the Apes. You are listening to the visual sounds of Mike Worf. Please press fast forward, let side one of the tape or cassette expire, and turn tape over for part two. The story ended with a cliffhanger. What came of his noble act of self-renunciation will be told in the next book. Simple, yes. Yet that first Tarzan was lush not only with the virtue of the jungle, but the unending daring do. Tarzan and the jungle animals thundered and slithered and roared from the pages. There is an elemental poetry in the description, such as that of the young Tarzan bending over a lake with a cousin ape to observe their reflections. His tiny slit of a mouth and those puny white teeth alongside the mighty lips and powerful fangs. The little pinched nose, which he compared with the beautiful broad nostrils of his companion. And the jungle boy's unfolding awareness that he is different has real poignancy. When using his intelligence, he was able to best his rivals and become king of the tribe, and readers gloried in his victory. All Story promptly bought Tarzan of the Apes and ran it complete in the October 1912 issue. 2 years later, the book came out in hardcover. It was a bestseller, going over 1 million copies the first year. And despite Burroughs' long record of failure, his varied career had provided him with a useful knowledge of people and places. The fourth son of a one-time Union Army major, who became a well-to-do distiller and storage battery manufacturer in Chicago, Edgar grew up with dreams of military glory. He took entrance exams for West Point and flunked, served in the United States Cavalry's 7th Regiment of Custer fame in Arizona, herded cattle in Idaho, and dredged for gold in Oregon. Failing to make a lucky strike, he went on to peddling travel lectures door-to-door in Chicago. He wrote many years later, "If at any time I had been satisfied, there never would have been a Tarzan. Sometimes the best break you can get is a bad break." During his first year as a full-time writer, Burroughs turned out more than 400,000 words. He was a one-man natural, able to plot a story in his head and complete it in 6 weeks. He never rewrote, and he reread only to check inconsistencies. Burroughs' multifaceted King of the Apes served in the House of Lords, assisted the Paris police, lived briefly in Hollywood, and fought with the Allies in the South Pacific during World War II. Returning to a prehistoric civilization, Tarzan tangled with ant men and lion men and other assorted monsters and magicians reported in no other source of African information. Burroughs refrained from ever visiting the Dark Continent. "I've seen more of Africa through the eyes of trained observers than I could ever have done myself." He maintained this, and he did in fact accumulate an extensive private library of Africana. In 1918, Tarzan came to the silent screen in the person of Elmo Lincoln, a 200-pound former Arkansas peace officer. That first Tarzan movie, shot on location in the bayous of Louisiana, was one of the first films to gross over $1 million. 14 years later, giant Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer authorized Irving Thalberg to produce Tarzan the Ape Man. Thalberg found his star in Olympic swimmer Johnny Weissmuller, who thereupon began a 12-picture reign as the 6th and definitive screen Tarzan. Because movies had now become talkies, Tarzan's triumphant cry would be heard for the first time, and MGM went to painstaking lengths to create a startling sound. Soundtracks that recorded the snarl of a dog, a hyena's laugh in reverse, a soprano's high C in low, slow speed, and the bow's harsh slash across the violin string, the bow playing as hard as it could, were blended with the track of Weissmuller himself yowling. Soon boys throughout the United States, and eventually the world, were reproducing the sound while banging their chests and falling out of trees and breaking legs. One of Burroughs' lifelong disappointments was the feeling that his motion picture never really said what he wanted to say. The aggravation of having his highly intelligent ape man turned into a grunting ignoramus. With the Johnny Weissmuller movies, "Me Tarzan, you Jane" became a popular catchphrase. But Burroughs Tarzan spoke 27 languages and once said to Jane, "I have come across the ages out of the dim and distant past, from the lair of primeval man, to claim you." As a memorial to their father, Burroughs' children recently engaged a scriptwriter to prepare the sort of movie he always hoped for. The story of a man's search for his own identity. And perhaps someday, it will be offered to the major studios with the proviso that it must be shot as it was written. Never interrupting the golden flow of words that is said to have brought him more than $10 million, Burroughs continued to indulge his own chronic craving for adventure after he moved to a 550-acre ranch in California's San Fernando Valley in 1919. Daughter Joan and sons Hulbert and John Coleman remember bounding out of their bed at dawn to gallop after their father, who became Tarzan on horseback. He loved it too when at 67 he became the oldest war correspondent in the Pacific Theater, covering the home front and parts of the Pacific for the Honolulu Advertiser. For a while, he was able to live adventures that he had only written about before. "I'm just an average person," he would say, "and I guess anything that interests me should interest others. My books entertain, and that's all they're intended to do." After 24 books and 39 movies, The King of the Apes has become an indestructible, if not immortal, folk hero. On Kaleidoscope, our presentation, King of the Jungle, Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Again, we bring you another chapter of Edgar Rice Burroughs' amazing history of Tarzan of the Apes. The astounding record of a superman who became the master of beasts and the mighty monarch of the African jungle. By the grace of a kindly God and the tender care of Kayla, at whose breast the little son of Lord and Lady Greystoke was nourished, Tarzan grew to young manhood. From his natural parents, he had inherited fineness and intelligence. And from his foster mother, Kayla, and the ape tribe, he had acquired tremendous strength, amazing agility, and animal cunning. And some 20 years since his abduction, we find Tarzan swinging through the jungle, a young man, splendid both in his youth and manhood. Carelessly, Tarzan's body swings from branch to branch. There's an easy grace about his perilous leaps and accurate catches as he progresses from limb to limb, which suggests both the assurance of the ape and the flowing rhythmic grace of a trained trapeze artist executing an often rehearsed feat of daring. Tarzan is off on a holiday. He's returning to the one place in the entire jungle that is his own, a place he had discovered long ago, a tiny hut on the shore of the great water. It has taken him many years to learn how to manipulate the odd mechanical thing which had swung open to him the door of that hut, which he would have been surprised to learn was the home of his mother and father and his birthplace. However, the door of that hut had opened to him more than the interior of the rude cabin which Lord Greystoke had built for his wife and son. It had taught him that he was M-A-N, not an A-P-E. It had taught him to read and write after a fashion. For hour after hour, year after year, he had pored over the first primer which he found there. But perhaps more important to his physical being and survival, it had given him access to the hunting knife which hung at his side, and the locket which dangled from his throat. Occasionally, Tarzan left the ape tribe and ventured to his hut near the seashore, and now he's making his way there. It's late afternoon. The sun of a dying day is filtering through the dank foliage of the trees to make an intricate pattern of onyx and gold on the spongy mold on the ground beneath. The jungle is reverberant with sound. The chatter of monkeys, the singing of birds, and the occasional growling and snarling of the larger animals as they make their imperial way to the waterhole.
Tarzan is happy. Happy as a schoolboy on a holiday. Swinging along his tail as a boreal way, he inhales the dank, pungent smell of the jungle with boyish delight. And the grim grandeur, the poisonous beauty of the jungle fills his soul with a feeling for which the ape language has no name. Meanwhile, off the West African coast, a small tramp steamer is plying her way through a placid sea. In the tiny salon of the ship are four people. Professor Porter, an old savant who exists in the present but lives in the archaeological past. His daughter, Jane, a beautiful girl whose charm is not only that of beauty but of wholesome loveliness and intelligence. Of these charms, the young man of the group is fully aware. He is William Cecil Clayton, a young Englishman, typical of the blonde, blue-eyed Oxford gentleman, and eldest son of Lord Greystoke. The other man in the salon is the captain of the ship.
What are you reading, Father?
Yes, of course, my dear, of course.
I asked you what you were reading.
Oh, sorry. A book, Jane. One of those dusty ones that you persist in believing gives me my hay fever. It's called Africa Christiana. Morchilli wrote it in 1816.
Only 1816? That's rather current fiction for you, isn't it?
Well, a man ought to keep up with modern literature, or he's liable to become an old fogey, Clayton?
I suppose anything published after the flood would be considered rather modern by an archaeologist, wouldn't it, Professor Porter?
Yes. No. What did you say?
Oh, go on with your reading, Father. We won't disturb you anymore. We're almost there, aren't we, Captain Tracy?
I beg your pardon?
Well, honestly, I don't know which is the worst, you or Father. It's enough to give a person an inferiority complex. I'm the only one aboard that seems to find me most fascinating.
You're forgetting me, aren't you?
Well, one could never forget anyone so gallant. But really, Captain, a person would think that you were burdened down with all the worries of the world.
Not all of them, Miss Porter, but I'm afraid I have my share.
Oh, really? What?
Merely a matter of ship's discipline. Nothing really important, I hope.
Beg pardon, sir, but I'd like to see you, sir.
Yeah, what kind of discipline is this, Newton? Coming in without knocking. Take off your cap.
Yes, sir. Sorry, my lady.
Well, what is it? What is it?
I'm afraid, sir. Don't ever let them know I told you, sir. They'd skin me alive. That's what they do, sir. They'd skin me alive. Blight, sir.
What are you talking about?
Mutiny, sir. Down below deck, sir. Mm. They're all in the forecastle, sir.
Mutiny? Mutiny? Isn't there some law about that?
Mutiny, I smelled it coming. That rotten crew we shipped at set. My compliments to Mr. Yount, Newton. And tell him to report to me at once. Here. I'll batter those deck guys down in their hatch and scuttle them like rats.
Beg pardon, sir, but it's the first mate off that's leading the mutiny, sir. He's down in the glory hole talking to him now, sir.
Oh, he is, huh?
Is there anything I can do, sir?
Don't worry, Clayton. I'll clean this affair up in a minute. You keep Miss Porter and the professor from being frightened.
I'm not at all frightened.
Beg pardon, sir. I'd better get below before they miss me. They'd kill me if they knew I'd informed you, sir.
All right, Newton. I'll remember this. Go below, then, and save your skin.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Clayton, we'll find two automatics in the drawer of that desk. You'll take one and come with me?
Certainly.
What am I going to use?
Oh! Good Lord! It's Newton! Come on, Clayton!
Righto! What's the matter? Is the door stuck?
That's nothing! We're barred in!
While the voyagers from the world outside are at the mercy of a mutinous crew, miles away, Tarzan is hanging from a tree branch, overlooking a clearing in the forest, and sees the beginning of a jungle tragedy. Sabor, the lioness, is dozing, surrounded by her happy family. One of her cubs wanders beneath the tree that hides Istar, the snake, the silent, strangling horror of the jungle. Istar, hungry and alert, drops part of her great and snarling length down from the branch and circles the cub, draws it up into the tree to slowly force it down into a constricting being by the undulating, torturous contraction of those great ringed muscles. Sabor, the lioness, awakes to the danger with a snarl of mingled rage and anguish, hurls herself with a terrific leap to rescue her cub. She misses. Again and again she leaps in a frantic effort to reach the snake. Her roar shreds the chaotic monotone of the jungle into tatters. Sabor's bestial anguish moves Tarzan to pity. He falls forward, giving himself a tremendous impetus with his legs and catapults himself through the air. It's a tremendous leap, superhuman. He's leaping for the end of Hister's tail. If he makes it, he may not be able to cling to that slimy, lashing length and will fall to the infuriated beast below. He won't make it. He won't. He does. He slips. He holds. His weight nearly jerks Hister loose from the branch. Like lightning, Hister contracts to lash him to the ground. But Tarzan lets go, drops to the branch beneath. Grasping it just in time, he falls fast. He dangles for a brief moment, but just for a moment. A snarl warns him. He's hanging close enough to the ground to be in reach of Sabor's vicious leaps. He pulls himself up to the branch. The tip of one of Sabor's claws cuts a tiny gash in his heel. He stands on the branch, gathers himself for a leap. Oh! fist a sinuous body, slaps itself around his waist, tightens.
Then slowly commences to draw him up to the branch above, where it can hold him fast against the branch and exert the terrific pressure which will crush him. Tarzan struggles terrifically, but slowly, slowly feels himself being drawn. Tarzan's mind races. With a great effort, he unwinds the grass rope around his waist, snatches the long hunting knife from its sheath, and plunges in it in the narrow part of the reptile's tail. The snake writhes, but doesn't lose its hold. Hastily, Tarzan works the blade through the resisting muscular strength until the handle protrudes at one end and the blade at the other. The serpent's agony has caused it to lose the distance it's gained in drawing Tarzan to the branch on which it lies. Tarzan is on the level with the branch from which he's drawn. Hurriedly, he ties the rope above the knife, letting it slide down the snake's body until the knife keeps it from slipping. Then, working like a madman, he snubs the rope around the branch. Hister strains. The branch creaks ominously, but doesn't break. The pain of pulling against the knife in his body makes Hister slowly release its hold on Tarzan.
In motion pictures, on radio, in books, in children's books, the adventures of the King of the Jungle, Tarzan. Entertain, and that's all they're intended to do. That's the whole appeal. Every year, new readers succumb to that appeal every time another boy or girl picks up a copy of the book that Burroughs wrote out of desperation many years ago and is off flying through the bending and swaying branches with incredible swiftness from one lofty branch through a dizzy arc to a neighboring tree, high above the black depths of the great jungle beneath. Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle, lives again.